now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Porridge, banana,
maple syrup.
We need to get this podcast sponsored by like Quaker Oats, don't we, or something?
That's the one I get as well.
Yeah. We can make it happen. And then we get you on the cover in a kilt.
I know, I've got the legs for a kilt though.
Yeah. Should it?
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're pondering one of the biggest questions in life. Was meatloaf right? Is 2 out of 3 really not that bad? Have we still got an epic title race on our hands? Those ponderings, of course, coming after Liverpool fell further behind Manchester City and Arsenal at the top of the Premier League table. We'll also be wondering what the future holds for Mo Salah, dissecting another thriller at Villa, looking at the relegation battle and asking, is Andoni Iraola the manager of the season? And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have football writer and Sunday Times columnist Alison Rudd, writer and European football expert Tom Allnutt, and a former footballer who isn't a fan of meatloaf, but did perform Take That's classic Back for Good as his initiation song when he joined Grimsby Town. Gregor Robertson is here, and mate, I just want you to know that we might fall out from time to time, but whatever I said, whatever I did, I didn't mean it.
Very nice.
Well done, Tom.
Thanks. I had a week off. I've been working on that all week in Italy on my sun lounger, and I'm so pleased. So pleased with it. And also, excitingly for listeners, there's another initiation song, but I don't want you to reveal it now.
Because you're going to
I'm going to use it for Thursday.
Of course.
You know, we're nearly there, mate. We've nearly done the whole season.
I know. And then that's it, surely.
Well, we need to work out what we're going to do next season. We get loads of new listeners who are like, there's this great gag they do at the start all about Gregor Robertson. Anyway, we'll come back to more songs later, but to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and further proof that Arsenal have definitely progressed this season, as not only do they win the big games, but they also manage to hold off the little wobbles at the end. Tom Allnutt, you were there. And I've got one of my usual that Monday morning ponderings for you.
Go on then.
Was this Arsenal being very, very good, or Spurs being not very good?
It was a funny game because I sort of felt like Arsenal were 3-0 up at half time, but arguably Tottenham.
We all felt that because it was actually true.
It felt like they were 3-0 up at half time, but actually Tottenham had kind of been arguably the better team. I mean, they'd had most of the ball, had a lot of good chances. Being there in the stadium, it didn't feel like a kind of like a 3-0 game.
Mm. Very interesting you say that. Just to interrupt, I was just speaking to my colleague Nick, who is a Tottenham fan, who was there. And I said, "Oh, you know, what's your kind of honest take?" And he said, "You're going to think I'm deluded here, but the first 20 minutes was arguably some of the best football we've played in general." So it's interesting that you then say that as a kind of impartial reporter.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing all the right things that you would want to do in this kind of game. You know, they were winning all the 50-50 tackles, they were pressing really high, they made a really good start, to be honest. But then equally, I think, in the second half, you'd say that Tottenham's comeback kind of came out of nothing as well. You know, it was almost like all the goals in this game sort of came against the run of play, or against the sort of what you would think the teams were deserving on the basis of their performance. Arsenal were pretty comfortable in the second half, I think, but they gave away a really cheap goal with a mistake, obviously, from Rea chucking out to Romero's foot, and then a late penalty, which ultimately came a little bit too late. I mean, if Spurs had kind of maybe scored the second goal 10-15 minutes earlier, then maybe we might have seen a real kind of climax. But I actually didn't think Tottenham's comeback ever really had much belief or momentum behind it, really, in that second half. And arguably they played their best football in the first half, but we know what Tottenham are like. This is where Spurs are. They're a nice team to watch. They're pretty. They do all the nice kind of attacking things very well, but they can't defend. They concede. Every time Arsenal got a corner, there was a sense in the stadium they were going to score, and every time Arsenal went forward on the counter attack, they looked like they were going to score. And that is obviously not a sustainable approach. And equally, Arsenal, I think, you know, they had a bit of a wobble in the second half, but they saw it out in that last sort of 6 or 7 minutes. They did all the right things that you would expect a kind of professional team to do. They kept it in the corner, won the fouls. And this was a huge result for them. You know, even though I think it was a bit weird for Spurs, because I think they came away from it relieved they didn't get thrashed, because for a good sort of hour or so, this looked like one of those games where they might get pumped 5 or 6 nil, which we've seen before with this Spurs team. They were sort of encouraged by kind of the valiant attempt at a comeback. But ultimately, you know, they're further off fourth and Arsenal are closer to the league. And for Arsenal, you know, yes, there was a late wobble, but this was a huge result for them in terms of the title race.
I'm going to come to some of the points you make about Arsenal with you, Alisson, in a second. But Gregor, on Tottenham and defending, you've obviously said for all season, there is no plan B. This is the Ange way. Let's enjoy it. But as Tom makes the point just then on this show and also in his piece today, Spurs are great to watch, but they're also great if you're playing against them, because they give you a chance. Is there any sense or desire, do you think, for us to see, if it's not a plan B, but plan A brackets point two?
Well, the thing that will be, you know, there'll be some unease about, I think, among the Spurs fan base is, like, you know, even the way that Ange spoke about spoke after this game, he said Arsenal are a team that deals with the details well, which was an honest assessment, because it, you know, the set pieces changed the game, changed the game state, gave Arsenal something to hold on to. But then he's also slightly dismissive about making Spurs a team that deal with the details well. And certainly when he's talking about set pieces, he's like, I think he said, if I thought fixing defensive set pieces was the answer to us bridging the gap, then I'd put all my time and effort into that. Like, clearly Spurs don't just do nothing on set plays, but there is just a sense, isn't there, about Ange's sort of evangelical approach to our game, the way we play, that's the way we discuss it all the time, that will trump all. And that's not the truth. Arsenal have, you know, their set pieces this season have changed so many games, so many times where they couldn't break down in like an obdurate low block. They've changed the game for them. And I'm not just talking about set pieces alone. We're talking about maybe tweaking the way that, you know, they leave themselves so open to a counter as well. So, like, Tom summed it up in his piece today, there's just sort of a lot of question marks about what the next step is for Spurs. You know, clearly it's about improving the squad, but is there any room for any sort of, just, I don't know, making Spurs a little bit, you used the word gritty, I think, a little bit grittier.
That is what's
taken Arsenal to the brink of winning the Premier League title this season.
Is it better players? Do they need better players? Is it the, you know, the Pep Guardiola argument of, this is the way I play, I just need better players, I'll try it with Gael Clichy and people, no, not good enough, I'm going to get better.
There
players.
Is an element of that. I think they need, you highlighted as well, you need the players who are, they're kind of holding midfield player. Bissouma's kind of fallen off it a bit, hasn't he? And he obviously didn't play in this game. That's such an important role for any sort of, you know, elite club these days as well. We know that, we see the value in the kind of number sixes. We see how much Declan Rice changed Arsenal. The same would be true of for Spurs, I think. They've got two really good athletic centre halves. They've got fullbacks. You know, Pedro Porro is a bit questionable defensively, but when Spurs have 70% of the ball, he's great on the other side of it. Same with the Doggy. Possibly they could do with an, well, a bit of a backup there. But I think the most important player, I don't know, Tom would know more about this than me, I think, is a holding midfielder.
Well, that's the thing, because the back five, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but you look back at, for example, at Arsenal when they started under Arteta, you know, fragile team, naive team, very technically gifted, nice to watch. You know, okay, the comparison kind of goes a certain way. But there were easy upgrades to make there. You know, Saliba, Gabriel, Ben White have all come in, you know, even Rea more recently. For Spurs, you look at that back five and you think, actually, they're pretty good there. Yeah. You know, that's not really the area you think they need a new left-back, they need a new centre-back. You know, it's not going to be fixed just by signings alone. I agree with Gregor that there may be something here in the midfield balance. Defence midfielder, I also wonder about Maddison in a midfield three. You know, I wonder if, can you ever have a team that is truly sort of solid and hard to beat when you have Maddison in the midfield three? But ultimately, it's not just going to be about signings. And that's where I think it kind of comes into this thing that, does the kind of Ange ball way ever incorporate this? I don't know if it's just about the style, but it's also about the kind of, I don't want to go back to the kind of Conte idea at Spurs, but he, you know, he often talked about Tottenham were never killers. You know, they never had this killer instinct, you know, and I look at Spurs now and I just think they're such a nice team. You know, even yesterday in the derby, like, there was a moment where Van der Ven sort of outran Martinelli and the crowd were absolutely like fired up, and Spurs had just scored, I think, to make it 3-1. And it really needed something more than Van de Ven just sort of picking up Martinelli and giving him a handshake and a pat on the back. You know? And I just thought, this is what Spurs are. They're such a nice and polite team. You know, actually what Van de Ven should have done was sort of said, brushed him off and sort of pushed him away and said, we're on the comeback here, you know. But they let Ben White stand in front of Vicario. they let Arsenal sort of not bully them, but they don't do all these things that you actually have to do to be a proper serious team. I think they're a fun team. I don't think they're a serious team.
Interesting, because that's definitely something you could say about Arsenal this season, Alisson. In some of the things that Tom's talked about there, and Greg are saying, you know, we got better at scoring corners. We learnt ways to win games. So my question to you, almost kind of riffing off that Tottenham thing in relation to Arsenal, is whether or not they win the title this season, are this Arsenal team now looking like winners, proper winners?
Yeah, this was a really good example of it, I think. They did exactly what was needed. What you had was a team that was pragmatically and meticulously coached against one that was emotionally coached. And maybe in a derby you can argue emotion's very important, but Arteta did the right thing and just pushed it away, the emotion. I just pressed the button on my player of the season vote for Martin Ødegaard, and it felt like he had deliberately had his least attractive game, because that was not what was required. It was grown up energy, yes, hassle, yes, but no need to be overly pretty, just be a captain, just work hard. And he looked a bit tired by the end, so he came off. There was no romance about keeping him on the pitch either. It was, I mean, there's a little photograph in the game today of Ben White fiddling with Vicario's gloves, trying to, I can't quite believe that's true. He's trying to undo them just before he has to come for a corner.
I thought
kick.
He was
that's
grabbing
hilarious.
His kind of like Under Armour thing. He was like, it was just an annoyance, wasn't it? It's great.
Just a little naggy
absolute
thing.
Box
that's
office. Not accidental. That
no, of
is,
course not. No.
That is coached.
Yeah. That's Nicholas Jover. Yeah, I did a profile kind of piece of him, and he's the detail he goes into, and it does kind of real one-on-one sessions with players and tries to think who's the best for this role. And there's some Ben White's like a bit of an enigma, isn't he? And it seems you wouldn't expect this from him, but he seems to have absolutely taken to this role with relish.
Is that a foul? I mean, if the ball comes in and Vicario hasn't got a glove,
oh god,
they
no.
score. Does that count as a free kick?
Oh god, no! Please, we're going to have enough of that debate when we talk about Chelsea and Aston Villa later. But in terms of Arsenal, in terms of some of those things, Tom, do you think Mikel Arteta deserves huge credit for the things Alisson has outlined there? Because we're talking about a North London derby, and we've got a leading football writer saying, well done, Mikel, no emotion. You put it all out the window. And this is Mikel Arteta, for goodness sake. That was his big problem.
Yeah, I do think that. I think we've seen Arsenal in the last week anyway, you know, which was a massive week. We'd go back to, you know, wasn't long ago that they'd lost to Villa and Bayern in the space of a few days, and everyone was thinking, let's see what happens now. Away at Wolves, away at Spurs, and the one in between was...
That was the Bayern game.
No, and home to Chelsea, obviously.
Oh, yes,
in,
of course,
in
yeah.
between. Three, you know, tough games, and they've come through all of them, you know, pretty smoothly, really. I don't think Arsenal had done that last year. I mean, they didn't. We know they didn't. You know, and this is the difference now, that Arsenal are a much more polished machine. They're much more ruthless. You could see in the way they managed the game yesterday, they were just, you know, Arteta kind of talking about getting the ball in the corner, the professional fouls they did, the substitutions they made. And we can see that they're not as fun, Arsenal, to watch. They're nowhere near as good and free-flowing as they were last season, but they are a much more kind of solid side now. And I think, ultimately, you can only say that in a lot of other Premier League seasons, they would have enough, this team, to win the league. A lot, you know, I haven't gone back over it. I don't know what the points tally will eventually say. But in terms of the eye test and the quality they have all over the pitch, and we know there are certain areas they can improve, left back, up front, whatever. But in general, this Arsenal team looked to me like a team that in many Premier League seasons would be champions. And it is the case that you have to be extra, extra special now to beat City.
So in many ways, their fate may well be to become the next Liverpool and lose the title by a point, you know, from 1 year to the next.
Get 95, 96, 97 points and still not be quite good enough. Well, that might just be the case, because Pep Guardiola and Manchester City keep rolling on. 2-0 win against Nottingham Forest. Gregor, this wasn't as straightforward as I've just made it sound with that 2-0 easy win. Forest gave City a good game in that first half, didn't they?
Yeah, and they had some chances. And I was saying earlier, I did really enjoy Pep Guardiola's kind of little pointed remark at the end about the pitch, but how they were very fortunate that Forrest missed several chances because of the stickiness of the pitch, which they'd clearly it was clearly a tactic before the game.
He's getting less subtle with his digs, Pep Guardiola, isn't he?
Yeah, it was subtle enough. Yeah, Chris Wood obviously missed two glaring opportunities in particular, but you know, he's someone who is who's probably surprised us with the number of goals he scored this season. And this was a big, you know, this was a banana skin for Forrest. People, we were talking about this the other day with Tony, and Tony was kind of a bit, you know, he wasn't expecting Forrest to put up much of a fight, but no. It's the City ground when it's really, you know, it's raucous best, and, you know, there's a bit of a sense of injustice sort of brewing at the place as well, rightly or wrongly. This was a tough game for them, and it could have been different. As I say, Forrest could have been a couple of goals ahead at, you know, in the first half, and then City just, as they always do, found a way and were clinical when it counted.
Were you watching that, like me, and thinking, I don't really get how Forrest could go down when they play like this? They look, they have so much. Yeah, they didn't finish, but otherwise they had a lot of confidence, a lot of pace, really expansive football, really. And given their position in the league, there was a freedom to them as well. They didn't. What tends to happen when you're in a relegation battle is you tighten up emotionally and physically, and you don't have that ability to play joyous football. But it was attractive to watch, and they looked like they were enjoying it, and they could go down.
I think fundamentally, it's the two penalty areas. It always has been all season. They've got a wreck in them. The goalkeepers has been an issue through the season. They've often thrown in goals. And they've just not had someone to put the ball in the back of the net all the time, despite that pace and the dynamism and Gibbs White's creativity. That's what they've lacked.
Hold that thought, because we're going to come back to the relegation scrap at the end of the show. We're talking about the title race now, and this morning you'll all know that I've just commissioned a little piece from you all looking at the final fixtures for the two teams now in the title race.
I didn't know this.
Alison, yeah, because I've not asked you. You take too long to do your work. This is like a quick job. We just need a quick bit of assessment. Well, I was interested in the fixtures that are coming up, and we're going to talk about the brilliance of Bournemouth later. Alison, you've talked wonderfully about how great Fulham are. Wolves can be a tricky side. You know, when we look at the fixtures that have got left, Arsenal have Bournemouth, Manchester United and Everton, their final three games. Manchester City have Wolves, Fulham, Spurs and West Ham. Do we actually see either of these teams dropping any points? I do. I think City actually have a tougher fixture running than those. Not just because they have an extra game, but I think Spurs might be out to prove Tom Allnut wrong. That they're not just a nice team.
Very specifically,
they're not just a nice team. They can also spring a surprise, which wouldn't be a huge surprise, I don't think. Spurs at home for Manchester City. He hates the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, Pep, doesn't he? Alison, have I got any hope, or is it going to be 9 points for Arsenal, 12 for City, another title for Pep?
I don't want to ruin your commissioning hat thing, but...
Well, I've commissioned it already, so it's
I
fine.
Know, but it does feel...
Does Tom have a commissioning hat?
He does have a
commissioning
hat.
Puts it on, sends out the commission.
Yeah, and then takes it off again. I've got quite a big head, so I don't like to wear it for too long.
It's just that it's not up to the opposition, is it? I was at Brighton v City on Thursday night, and Brighton did all the things I've been moaning that clubs ought to do against City, which is don't be scared of them. Play your normal game. And it just backfired every 10 seconds. So it was ridiculous. And seems odd to say it because they've been in some great Champions League games and so on. But I mean, that must have been... I think it was the best City have played this season, just from the way everyone sat around me reacted to that. Because there were broadcasts... I was in the sort of broadcast section, not the written press section. And there were lots of pundits and people looking at each other with that look that you give when you've just seen something, you know, you've just discovered the atom or something, you know, it's like, did I really just see what I just saw? Because they were phenomenal. And they were phenomenal partly because it just didn't work for Brighton, this fearlessness. They tried to pretend they weren't playing City, so they were passing it around at the back. They were trying to storm through the pitch. They were trying to be aggressive. They were trying to press. They were not playing differently because it was City. They had energy, but City just decided to just swat them aside like a mosquito and play the way they wanted to play. And it was slightly spooky that there was just all lots and lots of, you know, no-look passing and flicks and people I mean, formation wise was an utter mess, but it was beautiful because everybody knew where everyone was going to be.
So
they clicked phenomenally.
You're seeing City is what you're saying.
No, but no, because I don't think they've been. I don't think they have been. I don't think they have been that good all season. I think against Forest they were deeply average, actually.
So you think
it's about them? So that's my point. My point is, which City clicks well or clicks averagely? And it might be that it ends up being a complicated formula. So, for example, they go to Craven Cottage. And
lovely Marco and the boys.
Marco Silva has
off the boil a bit though.
Well, he has promised to be professional in that game.
That's good of him.
Which is very good of him. Let's trust him. And then they won't be on the beach. And so what happens there? Just two things can happen. Fulham play the way they want to play, which is very attractive football when they give it a go. And City react the way they did against Brighton, trying to do the same. Or City don't quite click. Because when it's that complex, when the interactions on the pitch are that complex, it can fall apart a little bit. And Fulham have learned to score in recent weeks. So I think it's possible, but it's less about Fulham and more about City. They're a bit odd, I think, City this season, when they switch on and when they just coast to it. So I don't think it really matters how well Wolves or Fulham or whoever play. It's about what City do with that. It's not about nerves at all. They don't have nerves. They've done it. This will be their fourth consecutive title if they win it. It's not nervousness. It's just occasionally it looks like they're just a little bit bored by it all.
So who's going to win the title? Whether they switch around. Who's winning the title then?
Well, it's probably City.
Oh, for goodness sake. Gregor Robertson, City Steamroller correspondent. I'm still so sad that show disappeared where you said Arsenal were going to win the title, because it just doesn't exist.
Didn't happen, Tom.
It did. It did. You genuinely believed for one show. I assume you're Team City. Not Team City, but you know.
I am. It's fascinating, though. I think my eyes drawn, just with the fixtures here, my eyes drawn to Everton and for Arsenal home on the final day, and like, if, you know, Sean Dyche would revel in that.
Oh, he'd absolutely love it.
Dominic Calvert-Lewin's fit, like, I don't know. And even, you know, just Manchester United are absolutely woeful and they're like almost a comedy team at the moment, but you just never know when it's at Old Trafford and a game between Arsenal and United. But like, fundamentally, as I have said year after year after year, City are now 19 games unbeaten. I know that they need to probably win all the remaining games, but I think they probably will.
Tom? You said Arsenal are the best team. Will they be the title-winning team?
I mean, obviously the Tottenham game for City is the one, I think, that sticks out. It will be a really weird atmosphere for Spurs, because they will be thinking, if we win this game, we hand Arsenal the title. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a really Spurs thing to do, to kind of go and beat City and hand Arsenal the league.
It's the new version of Spursy. It's the new Spursy. Make sure Arsenal win a title.
I mean, the whole kind of Spurs against City thing, I think, was more of a thing with Mourinho and Conte ball and sort of late Pochettino, when they sort of frustrated City. I think this new version of Spurs is a very kind of nice, open team to play against for City. I don't see them winning that. I look at Arsenal's games. I think I agree with Gregor that the Old Trafford match, particularly, I think that one is the one that comes after. So City play first that week, and by that time, I think City will have played their games in hand. So they could be top by then, and Arsenal will be having to win to kind of go back. So that could make a difference. You know what? I actually think Bournemouth, you look at that as a sort of a home slam dunk, but I think the way Bournemouth are playing, the way Iraola sets up, and just kind of coming off this trio of games, Wolves, Chelsea, Spurs, when Arsenal would have been so set on those three games sort of psychologically, it just looks to me like a little bit of
so you're City by like 6 points by the sounds of it.
I think City will probably,
it's all word soup, just all you say City for me.
No, I'm saying Arsenal partly because I've said Arsenal for ages, and in this model world you double down.
Do you think they're gonna,
that City are gonna lose points in? I think they could drop points against Wolves and Tottenham. Clip that up and make sure you include Gregor's laughter in that meal as well the next time. Anyway, the reason we are talking about a two-team title race is because Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp are fading away as the season draws to a close. A 2-2 draw at West Ham. Who did we have there? Who had we sent? Alisson Rudd. It had to be you. Similar question to the one I asked Tom about the North London derby. Was this West Ham and David Moyes being good and like stepping up in a big game as they often do, or will Liverpool, you know, are they fading a little bit? Are they off the boil as at the key moments when it matters?
No, they're so off the boil. There were moments of actual silence in the stadium.
From you or from everyone else?
Everybody. I've never had that sensation ever at a Premier League game, let alone one that was still technically a title race. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Liverpool began like a team who did not believe they were in a title race anymore. The travelling fans didn't seem to believe it either. And yes, I do know the London Stadium can go quiet, and there is disquiet about the manager and the style of play. But normally when there's a top three team visiting them, they put all that to one side and make sure it's raucous, and because they like to see an upset. But until West Ham scored, there were actually moments when there was no noise at all. Nothing. Not even like mumbling or grumbling or tumbleweed. Or there was nothing.
The London Stadium's the worst place for that too. But, to happen.
Oh my goodness, this was supposed to be a game that... And it... Yes, you know, it's gone awry for Liverpool, but surely they were playing first at the weekend. If they'd played good football, won the game, you know, you might introduce a small percentage point of nerves or doubt amongst your rivals for the title, but they would have dismissed what happened at the London Stadium as being completely irrelevant as far as the title race was concerned. So it was a very strange experience. Well, and one thing I cannot account for, and maybe there's some sort of formula that someone cleverer than me can come up with, but the game went really fast. It went faster than any other game I've been
at. It seems like you were really saddened by this whole experience. You in a different, and it was like a bit of a daze for you.
Are you in the Matrix or something? Like it's a silent but really fast game.
I looked up and I was thinking, God, this is awful, this is dragging. And it was 70 minutes.
Is it like the old video players when you press fast forward so all the sound goes off? So it was going really quickly. Anyway, let's bring you back onto the issues of the game, because there's two that I want to talk about. One very quickly and one for all of us. Socks, Alison, is the one I want to talk about very quickly.
Well, this
socks.
Is...
Tell us
this
about
is,
socks.
This is...
And why it's cost Liverpool the title race.
Well, you know, we might look back and decide that refereeing did cost Liverpool the title race in terms of the game against Spurs where there was that ridiculous
Alison,
mistake.
Come on,
everyone knows that was the biggest blunder in the history of football, right?
Good process, lads.
And then you had this very, very, very strange situation where Areola is stood in his penalty box and he bends down and he throws the ball forward and starts pulling up his socks. So Cody Gakpo thinks, well, it's a loose ball there. I'll run up and score a nice goal. That might win us the title. And Anthony Taylor blows his whistle before Gakpo touches the ball, so Gakpo stops. And then there's this sort of strange, and yet another silence, a strange sort of what's going on. And it is a bit bizarre because no one knows what's going on. So Anthony Taylor says something to Areola, don't know what it was, and then he indicates to the West Ham bench that they should bring on some physios. Well, the physios don't think Areola's hurt. So they're all talking about what coffees they're going to buy afterwards, right?
And they're so quiet you could hear that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. They're looking at each other. Oh, what do we need to do? All we saw was him pulling his socks up. He was just pulling his socks up. He wasn't in agony. He was pulling his socks up. So do we need to get him some new socks? What's going on? And eventually they ran onto the pitch. Areola looked slightly confused. Am I supposed to be hurt? And then we have Peter Walton very kindly writes for us in the game saying, oh, we'd all be a lot more upset if Gakpo had scored. Well, no, the only person that would have been really upset would have been, people would have been Moyes and Areola, because Areola made a mistake by just...
Peter Walton,
ball,
who did say
the
that the referee
out.
Made the right call. As
no,
much
did,
as Areola was
make
lucky...
The right call. He didn't make the right call. It's in what way did he make the right call? It's not in the laws of the game.
It's funny.
To protect a player from pulling up his socks.
Both of his pieces today, we'll come on to the one about Chelsea,
we will.
Were essentially saying they didn't break the rules enough. That's what the referee is. That's what, you know, a former referee is saying. That's the position we are now in with like officiating. It's insane.
Anyway, let's not do it. Let's not go into refereeing and VAR. Hold off. Sound the alarm, because we're going to talk instead about Mo Salah and his little touchline tantrum and what it might mean for his future at Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp's on the way. Should he be on the way too, Alison Rudd, for the new era?
Well, he might be.
Should he be?
No, I mean, I would hope not. I would hope that whatever's gone wrong for Mo Salah in the past few weeks is temporary, because form is and class isn't. So he is undoubtedly one of the greatest strikers to have ever played in the Premier League, but he's not happy at the moment.
Mm.
And it was quite funny. I was in the mix zone at the at the London Stadium. And Mo Salah has never, ever stopped, ever, I don't think, in the mix zone. But that doesn't stop journalists asking.
So, just for listeners who don't understand
what a mix zone is. We've mentioned this before.
I know, but just for the new listeners that are joining all the time.
Well, you after the game, a small number of journalists are given passes to go into a sort of tunnel area where they put up barriers, and as players leave their dressing rooms to leave the stadium or walk towards, if you're the away team, towards your team bus, you can ask them to stop and talk to you. Normally, because you want to save a few juicy quotes for your follow-up piece.
Yeah,
but generally quite a dispiriting experience, isn't it?
Hit rate's not high, is it?
The hit rate. Well, you.
Which brings us back to Mo Salah.
If a team's won, and they have players that are good at talking to the media, then the hit rate's quite high.
Right.
But when a team's drawn, in this case, then no, your hit rate's very low.
And Mo Salah often
doesn't. Mo Salah never talks. But you say to the club official, any chance of getting Mo? And they smile. And then you see Mo Salah walking out, and some broadcast outlet shouted, any chance of a word, Mo? And he said, if I speak today, there will be fire. But said it in a very breezy, superstar-y sort of way.
Mm. Which, that's a real upgrade on the Jose Mourinho, if I speak, there will be trouble.
Yeah.
If I speak, there
will
be fire.
Absolutely.
He's really, yeah. He's, no, I respect that as well.
Yeah. But it was funny because he wasn't close to us. So a few of us thought he'd said, if I speak today, I'll be fired.
Ah.
So we thought, oh, what would he say that would get him fired? I mean, so I had to listen back through someone else's earphones, because it wasn't a recorded interview. It was something said in the corridor, and you're hoping someone picked it up. So you had it really loud in your ears. You know, it was a bit disappointing.
Was he smiling as he said it? Or was he...
He was.
Was there fire in his face as well?
No, there wasn't fire in his face. He looked superior, right. Like...
dismissive sort of.
Whatever I say will be right, but no one else
but
will
I'll
like
be
it
in trouble.
Sort of look
interesting.
Yeah,
you do reference in your piece today, which is largely about Salah, the big contract that of course Liverpool gave him was it only a year ago?
Two years ago. So he's entering his final year now.
Yeah.
And he's the highest paid player in the club.
We're heading into a new period for Liverpool. Michael Edwards' era, who knows who the manager's going to be. Maybe it'll be Arnie Slot. That's why I pose that question about Salah's future and whether a kind of clean break, new manager, new superstars type thing. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I think they should let him go. I do. I think they probably should let him go last summer, actually.
Saudi Arabia clubs sniffing
around.
Yeah,
they had a massive offer, 100, 150 million or something, wasn't it? And I take Alisson's point. Everyone knows Mo Salah is one of the best players in the history of the Premier League, and he still is an excellent player. But we have to say that this season he hasn't really been at his best. He's had injuries. He's missed... I think he had two different spells out, didn't he? To be fair, one was for the Africa Cup of Nations,
yeah.
And then one for an injury. And in the last few weeks, he hasn't been at it at all, I don't think. Not on the ball, not in his kind of usual kind of creative way, but also more tellingly, I think, off the ball. I think his kind of defensive work has been really poor. I just thought it was all a bit ugly, really. Like, we know where, you know, Klopp's leaving. I just didn't think he deserved that from Salah, and I suspect it's probably because these kind of top players, when they have these bad periods where they go through spells of not scoring, not playing well, not starting as many games as he wants, they do get this kind of pent up frustration, and I'm sure it was just kind of a result of that. But still, I just didn't think it was a good look, and I do think that with a new manager coming in, Salah turns 32 this summer, obviously on huge wages, teams like Liverpool, they can't afford to miss the opportunities to sell their best players for big money. You know, and this is that opportunity. I think it should have been ideally last summer, but I think it should be this summer. And if you look at City, for example, in same position with De Bruyne, he is stepping up at this moment in the title race when they need him. Salah didn't do that. And I'm not saying he should be sold because of punishment or whatever, but I think Liverpool should look at this with a real cold, black and white eye and say, actually, this is the best time now to evolve and remake this team without him.
Yeah, I think I agree entirely. I think it's always wise for a club to get ahead of the sort of decline of a major star when, as Tom's saying, they're on huge, huge money. And the opportunity to kind of cash in any way just disappears entirely.
It's the last opportunity, isn't it? Because in a year he goes for free.
Yeah. So. And it's a new start. It's you know, be a clean slate for everyone. I think it's a good, it's the right thing to do.
But do you genuinely think his performances since he came back from his hamstring injury are enough to write him off as being a superstar?
Of course not. He's still like one of the best players in the league.
So if he's one of the best players in the league, then surely you keep him. Your logic is all wrong.
There's a bigger picture.
If he's one of the best players in the league and you've got him, keep him.
There's a bigger picture to consider, though. There's always a bigger picture with it regarding any player. So, you know, if Erling Haaland, we've had this debate, if Erling Haaland is making City a less effective team despite scoring 50-odd goals, I think there's a conversation to be had about whether Erling Haaland should stay. Like, that sounds insane to a lot of people, and it sounds insane to me actually saying it, but I think there's a genuine conversation about whether Erling Haaland makes City better as a whole. So there's no player who's off limits for moving on, and particularly in this situation when the window of a kind of managing the decline of a player is very, very small. So... yeah, we should also say Tony's been quite prophetic about this recently.
He has. He's just going to say, final word for Tony Cascarino.
Not just about Liverpool following. He said he thought there'd be a lot to come out in the wash about the last couple of months, and I think, you know, possibly we're starting to see it.
Yeah, we'll wait until Tony's back next week to give him the full credit for his Liverpool prediction. But if you've got views on the future of Mo Salah and whether he should stay or go, or maybe you want to guess what Gregor Robertson's other initiation song was, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But stick with us for now. We're talking relegation and Andoni Iraola next.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times, this music-themed Game Football Podcast on this Monday morning. I'm not sure what music link is to the next thing, because Aston Villa threw away a two-goal lead, but thankfully Spurs dropped points, and we're talking about, once again, this battle for fourth place. Gregor, you were there at Villa Park. It was another thriller, as you often say you get at Villa. So it's the theme, it's the question I'm asking everyone. Was this good Villa, good Chelsea, bad Villa, and
bad
good
Villa.
Chelsea? Bad Villa.
Bad Villa.
Good Chelsea. Yes. Bit of good Chelsea?
Good Chelsea, yeah.
But start with bad Villa.
Bad Villa, okay. Well, they were quite fortunate to be two goals up in the first half. And then, you know, despite that fortune, they invited Chelsea right back into the game in the second half. I thought that... And Emery was quite spiky afterwards when he was asked very reasonable questions. Are you disappointed to have thrown away a two goal lead? He's like he was kind of eyeballing the interviewees, the interviewer saying... Disappointed. We've confirmed our place in the Europa League. The next, he was.
He does. I think love it was a bit. He does love the Europa League.
Yeah. Anyway, they were poor, but Chelsea were good. Chelsea even in the first half, they controlled possession. They created a few chances. Caicedo ball over for Jackson, and he was narrowly offside, with a good finish, and then he had another chance with a header that he hit the post, which he should have scored from. And the second half, after the capitulation against Arsenal, 2-0 down in your next game, they could have folded. And I think for as much as we criticised Chelsea, they did show a bit of kind of fight and spirit in the second half, and possibly could have won it.
Could have won it, should have won it?
No.
Mr. Football League defender, the amount of challenges you must have had in
I'm
your
surprised
playing
there's a debate.
Days.
I'm genuinely surprised there's a debate about this. I said it at the time.
A foul.
I said it at the time as it happened. I said it's a foul, and then they scored, and then we saw it on the screen again. They get the little screens in the press box. I said that's a foul, and all day long.
Were your colleagues in agreement with you in the press box?
Yeah. Beside me, there was a bit of a debate afterwards. I spoke to some people in the mix zone as well, and they were like. There were some people, and I know there's some people in this room who have different views, but it was basically the defender, who was Carlos, had a chance to head the ball clear, and because of Barry Sheely's nudge, however slim it was, that chance was taken away, and immediately the ball back into the box, they scored a goal from. So.
You see that at corners though all the time. Like, you see that kind of nudging, little push here and there. I mean,
a couple of the similar type pushes again the North London derby for Arsenal's goals.
Absolutely. Yeah, but in the do you mean in the box as in like in the maelstrom of a kind of from a corner kick? This was the ball had come out to the edge of the box,
well,
and it was like
it
two guys. There was no one else around them. No one else was going to win the ball afterwards. He nudged them to stop the only other player who could win the ball from not doing so. Put the ball back in the box. Goal. It had to be a foul.
Alisson, qualified referee, foul or not?
Yes, it was a foul. But what's wrong with it is that. There's an inconsistency about what's looked at again and what isn't. So
careful though. Careful.
Yeah, let's
careful. Careful.
It shouldn't have been overruled.
How can
it
you
wasn't
not
big enough to overrule it?
Well, come on. What?
Careful.
What?
Anyway,
how can there be something in the build-up to goal that's not big enough to overrule it? This is always going to be the flaw in VAR. It's impossible. It will never work. I've said this
Moses Caicedo, Gregor. Tell us.
Okay.
Tell us all about this midfield maestro and some hope for Chelsea with one of their big signings.
Yeah, he was outstanding. He's had a really tough time since he moved for a ridiculous fee from Brighton, and he's looked like a cause of and one of the many players who've been caught up in the mess and the chaos and the sort of uncertainty that is Chelsea. And there's also been the sort of issue about how he and Enzo Fernandez fit into the team, and now Enzo Fernandez is out with. I think he had to have groin surgery. He's out till the end of the season. There's a sort of feeling that possibly he's better, and you see this kind of full spectrum of his capabilities when Enzo's not in the team, because he's actually a player who's capable of being the box to box midfielder. He's always, at Brighton he was the holding player, the pivot, and he was the destroyer and the player who kind of just played the little passes between the lines and let everyone else get on with it. In this game, he was. Driving forward with the ball at his feet, he was playing. I think he played the most passes into the final third of any player on the pitch. He still did all the other stuff that we know he's good at, but he was dictating the tempo, switching play. He controlled the midfield against a good midfield. Villa have a strong midfield. I thought it was the best performance I've seen from him.
It's interesting reading your piece, because I was off, but I was watching this game, and then to read your piece, because I thought he stood out playing alongside Gallagher. And I remember watching Chelsea against Crystal Palace, and they won that game. But I was watching it, and it's kind of like Fernandes and Caicedo were giving each other the ball and going, "Wait, are you meant to be doing it? No, I'll sit here. You go. No, you go. No, I'll go here."
Yeah,
that feeling that you've signed two big players who've never played together before, and asking them, "Well, you're both brilliant, so be brilliant next to each other." And it's not that necessarily that simple.
No. I mean, how often do we speak about the balance between, you know, having the right mix of players in midfield? Many teams, Manchester United, have not had that for like 2 years. Gallagher is so good at, because he can cover. He's so industrious. He's got so much running in his locker that he can be the guy who crashes the box, and he can also cover for Caicedo when he's pushing forward. I still haven't said all this. You know, you saw hope from him, real hope from Caicedo, that, you know, what he could be for Chelsea. Madueke was outstanding as well. He was really had the bit between his teeth. But there's just so many, you know, caveats still. Mudrik was kind of, honestly, he just looked terrified. There was a period I watched him for about 20 minutes in the second half when he was on our side of the pitch, where if a Chelsea player had it in midfield or a defender had it and he was out wide, he didn't create an angle to open up a passing lane. Hmm. He just kept standing behind a player inside him. He looked scared to get. He genuinely looked scared to get on the ball.
He's at the fall
terrified.
Over the ball stage in his career development at the moment, isn't it? There was a point where he tried to do a bit of trickery and he forgot what bit of trick he was meant to do. And I think Matty Cash just pinched the ball off him, and then he gave away a foul and got booked for it.
It's painful to watch.
He's a great athlete, but I don't think he's got much football sense.
No, it was painful Mudrik. To watch.
Mm. Mm. Tom, what do you make of Gregor's points about Chelsea's midfield and Caicedo, Fernandes, Gallagher, that balance that they've got, and what Poch might take from that going forward?
Yeah, that balance hasn't been right all season, really.
No.
And it's tempting, I think, obviously, without Enzo, because they didn't have Enzo either in the win against Everton, did they, where they won 6-0 and played well. I mean, he was out for that game as well. So you start to wonder if they're kind of better without him. I just think Caicedo, there's always this kind of idea that he's a sort of a destroyer and that he can, you know, get around the pitch quickly. But I actually think he's not really like that. He's actually a bit more, he likes to be on the ball when he has to play make. And I wonder if that sort of balance with him and Enzo, they're almost trying to do the same thing too much. I mean, they're going to lose Gallagher in the summer. So, you know.
Well, that's what I was, you know, they nearly sold him in January. Yeah. You're watching this game, your captain having a pretty good performance and then curling one in the top corner and thinking, what? Why are you getting rid of this guy?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the thing with Chelsea, that some of the best players are the ones they're going to have to sell, and the ones that you don't want to keep, like Mudrik, are the ones they have to keep, you know? And so, I mean, long term, who knows? But, I mean, Chelsea just, you know, they've drawn to Sheffield United. They thrashed Everton. They got hammered by Arsenal in one of the worst performances of the whole entire season. And now they put on a really good display away at Villa. I mean, they're just and what Pochettino said the other day after the Arsenal game is absolutely right. You know, when they are bad, they are absolutely dreadful. But they can also be quite good, you know. And I mean, Madueke, I thought, played well in this game as well. And actually, in the last few games, he's been good as well, you know. And he's suddenly looking like a player that maybe they could build around, when actually, you know, he was involved in that whole penalty thing with Palmer. And you're sort of thinking, well, he's not the kind of personality that's maybe right for the team. And every time you see Chelsea, you're not really sure. You're not really sure what you're going to get. But they're right. They've got Spurs next at home. It's the team they want to beat more than anyone else. And, you know, they're still in that kind of European conversation. And if they get in there, then that's not a bad finish for Poch.
Their bench as well. I know they had a lot of injuries, but their bench, you know, you had to Google who they were. There were 17 and 18-year-olds from the academy who have never played a first-team game. There was a goalkeeper.
Times journalists don't know absolutely every single footballer in the Premier League.
A colleague told me, actually, that one of the players is Lloyd Dyer's son. Do you remember Lloyd Dyer?
The Watford.
Yeah. Winger. Yeah. That made me feel quite old, actually. And the goalkeeper, they had two sub-goalkeepers. One, Ted Curd, was on loan at Hashtag United earlier in the season. I take the injuries argument, but still, they spent £1 billion. They spent £1 billion in three transfer windows. And this is what they have.
I can't work out what is more your catchphrase. City always come. They always come. Or they spent £1 billion. I can't work out which is more your catchphrase. I'm going to get one of them on a T-shirt for you before the end of the season. Alisson, Aston Villa. stuttering, stumbling a little bit at times. They're 7 points clear of Tottenham, but Tottenham have two games in hand. Do we think they are going to solidify that top four place? Have they got enough to make sure they get over the line?
I think. Well, I do genuinely think they're the better coached team. I think Spurs are much more fun to watch, and we keep saying that every week, don't we? That we sort of half enjoy the madness that is Ange Ball, but there's something really quite grown up about Villa. And yes, they were disappointing in this game against Chelsea, but at no point did you think, oh, you know, Unai Emery, what a joke, or anyway, he can't get to grips with Chelsea, can he? They were just possibly, you know, they're the only English club fighting, you know, on two fronts in Europe and at home, and sometimes you will have slightly flat performances, but they're very well organised. And I think what they do well is they sort of, or what Emery does is he sort of acknowledges how the opposition are playing, how it's panning out, and they become quite dull and solid and just hope to catch you on the break. And it got them the point. You know, it's enough. I feel like it's proper grown up, not always beautiful, not always attractive, but they are the more grown up team. And I think probably the more grown up team finishes ahead of in the league than the one that is a bit over emotional.
I just want to say Aston Villa have on the mix zone conversation. Aston Villa have the worst mix zone in the Premier League by a country mile. It's a room.
The decor, or
it's a room that with two doors in. So like, there's, you don't even get the purpose of a mix zone is that you at least have the opportunity of asking a player to speak to you. The players walk out to the coach behind another wall, out through another door. So like, they have to be ushered in by someone else. And the only player who came in, Super John McGinn.
Super John.
He came in three times.
He heard you were there.
He'd been told he'd done it too many times by Aston Villa's press team that, you know, he wasn't allowed to speak. So he came in, he said, "I'm not allowed to speak, guys." And he came in.
Hiya, Gregor.
He came in three times.
Love you,
and
Gregor.
He chatted,
love you, know, Gregor.
He chewed the fat with everyone. He was talking about the VAR decision, like, all off the record. He was just a great guy.
Maybe that's your catchphrase. It's not actually about Chelsea.
Really,
it's just
John McGinn.
Yeah, well, who's the best? Who is he? Your best player in the mix then, John McGinn? Best for stopping, best for chatting. Loves a chat.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you got to say Virgil van Dijk is always, he's always there. Andy Robertson's another one who does it. But you know, you do have characters, you know, who you know who are going to be the people. But the club eventually kind of go, look, you can't do this every week.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that was the week I got.
Because it's a mix between the club press officer and the players wanting to do it, right? So sometimes you might get a player who doesn't want to do it as a kind of obligation and you get absolutely nothing from them.
Yes. And, you know, but although Aston Villa, I don't think they put anyone up. They were ignored. There was a guy from the local press who was like texting them and like getting blue ticked. So they just did. And it's extraordinary. They're fourth in the league. Like, having said, you know, that Villa were poor, it's still a remarkable season that they're having. And this is a broader thing about the control that clubs have now. And why should you not be talking about it and shouting about it?
Journalists quite like to kind of extract big conclusions from kind of mixed zone behaviour, I think. So like, there was a 3 or 4 year period basically where Arsenal put up no players for the mixed zone. It just never happened, right? And we were all like, this is why Arsenal, you know, they haven't got the sort of strength of character in the Twitter races. This was at the end of days.
They're
Wenger
scared of Gregor. Scared.
They haven't got the personalities, holding. You know.
Who's your best mate in the mix zone, Tom?
I mean, Kane used to be very good. He used to do it a lot. James Maddison, pretty good. Son does a lot of Spurs. Yeah.
Chelsea are the best club. They're very organised about it. And when the players don't want to speak, I mean, we've slagged off Chelsea a lot, haven't we? But they are very well run in the press room.
They brought out Cucurella, yeah. And he spoke quite well. So, yeah, I've nothing but good things to say about Chelsea.
It's worth saying that Arsenal got a lot better as well, you know. So the trajectory is consistent with their performance.
So not only are they getting good on the pitch,
they're now delivering in the mix zone.
They're delivering in the mix zone where it counts. Well, speaking of teams that should be shouting about their brilliant performances, let's talk about Bournemouth. Now, back in October, maybe September time, I remember sitting in this room on this podcast and turning to Gregor and saying, Gregor, Andoni Iraola, he might be the first manager to get sacked this season. And you said, no, Tom, just have a little patience. Remember that in football.
Have a little patience.
Everything changes. And that is to take that song's reference in one link. Thank you very much. Anyway. Listen, take that, man. They're from Manchester. What can I do? But anyway, since, as the table in the game shows today, Bournemouth have been one of the league's top performers since the start of October, with Brighton languishing in the relegation places. But Bournemouth, if we took the league table, 28 games since October, they would be fifth, which is absolutely bloody remarkable, if you ask me. So therefore...
I don't want to rain the parade, but I did notice.
There we go.
I did notice that
that's
the three teams below them had played either one or two games fewer, which were United, Spurs, and Chelsea.
Yeah, but still, don't let
it's still a remarkable
facts get in the way of a good, you know.
Yeah, there's no guarantee any of those three would have won them either. So
anyway, so yeah. That leads me on to try and save face for suggesting that Areola should be sacked and say, is he actually manager of the season, Alison?
He's close, I think.
Who is your manager of the season, and why is it not Areola?
Okay, put you on the spot there, isn't it?
I need to wait for the final table, I think.
You've just voted for Merton Odegaard for player of the season.
Yeah, but that deadline, isn't it?
The I'm giving you a deadline now.
There isn't an actual deadline.
Yes, there is.
I only worked a real deadline, yes, as you know.
Anyway, Iraola.
No,
fantastic.
Iraola, he won't be anybody's manager of the season, I don't think, because...
He's mine, always loved him, always rated.
They haven't been quite scintillating enough... And they have had some drab performances, but there's a lot to commend the whole deal at Bournemouth, which is we were all like, oh, what are they doing? What are they doing? Getting rid of Gary O'Neill. Mm. What do they know? And they've brought in someone and they've been patient with him. And his demeanour, the whole way he speaks is somebody who knows he's allowed to lose a game and that there won't be panic stations. He sees the bigger picture, the process. He looks very comfortable. And he inherited a squad, quite relatively cheaply assembled squad. And he's made them play very different style of football. And they've had to learn how to do that. So they're learning in front of us, which is always hard. He didn't get a pre-season. So that is a one... Can someone stop pinging when I'm talking?
It's Mikel Arteta and the Arsenal players getting in touch with Tom to say if they want to chat next time he's in the game. Because they're so good at stopping now.
But he had no pre-season to do this. And if the pluses in the column of why he should be manager of the season is that's really hard to do, is to come in with a radically different approach, take players who aren't world beaters and make them feel like they could be, and they are allowed to, as long as they work hard, they're allowed to express themselves and not be fearful of any opposition. Most of the time when I've seen them live, they've been really impressive, really, really impressive. And it's been great to watch players like Dominic Solanke openly say, oh, I wasn't really sure what he was asking me to do or where I was supposed to be positioned. But he's clearly got something about him as a coach because he's made them buy into it and they're excellent. And what was really good about the weekend's performance was they could only put eight players on the subs bench. They were torn apart by injuries because Brighton are too. But so they both had excuses ready. And yet Bournemouth, because they have a style of play and they can slot people in and out of it, and he's slowly getting through to the team what he wants from them, they are able to pull off results like that. So he has been and will continue to be, I'm sure, excellent. But it's about the whole thing, isn't it? It's about patience and deciding going forward, maybe not this season, next season, we want them to play this way.
I think Bournemouth are on like the cusp of being thought of in the same sort of way as Brentford and Brighton. I think they're like, you know, the way they got into the Premier League was like a miracle. It was all fueled by, well, you know, apart from the money. You know, a Russian benefactor. It was all the kind of the cult of personality of, you know, Eddie Howe and how he fueled that. And then they bounced around, you know, bounced back between the leagues. But now they've got a new stadium on the way. They've got a new training ground that they're moving into, I think, at Christmas. The recruitment suddenly looks really, really smart, like amongst the smartest in the league. Sporting director or technical director has been poached by Liverpool. They've got a ready-made replacement in Simon Francis, who's stepping in his shoes. They made a really bold decision. Yes, we debated it, and you could still debate it because Gary O'Neill's been brilliant at Wolves. But he delivered what they asked of him, which was a change in the style of play. And it took a while, but we're absolutely seeing it. We're seeing it in full flow now. And I just think that they're a club in a very good place. They've already passed their best ever points tally.
Tom, in terms of Iraola, then, might not be manager of the season for anyone, apart from me, just trying to save my embarrassment at my earlier prediction. But in terms of him, I don't want to do this to Bournemouth fans, but with lots of managerial vacancies up for grabs this summer, is there any case, whether it's this summer or in the future, that he could be kind of destined for a top, top, top job?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. I think Bournemouth did well to kind of step in before other clubs in the Premier League. I mean, he was already, I think Leeds tried to get him before and he decided to stay at Rayo in Spain. But he's definitely been kind of circled for a long time as a real talented up-and-comer. His team, Rayo in Spain, played really exciting, fun kind of football and on a very limited budget. His pedigree is you know, he played in the same youth team as Xabi Alonso and Mikel Arteta. They played in the same midfield. So this little, tiny little sort of Sunday league club in the middle of San Sebastian, Antiguoco, had a midfield of Xabi Alonso, Arteta and Iraola, kind of under 12s or something, you know. He used to kick a ball about on the beach in San Sebastian with Mikel Arteta every weekend. So he comes from this kind of like, you know, coaching talent factory in the Basque Country. Speaks great English. He played with Lampard and Vieira, didn't he, in America as well. I mean, Iraola is a very talented coach. I think he probably would be manager of the season if Bournemouth were slightly higher. I mean, what are they? They're kind of 10th. You know, yeah. I think if they were kind of more like 7th or 8th, then we would probably be talking about him right up there. But I also think it's possible, you know, there's always this kind of O'Neill versus Iraola, or, you know, Bournemouth chucked out O'Neill and look who they got. You know, it's very possible for them both to be good coaches. And for this to be a good decision for Bournemouth, you know, to kind of bring in someone who they thought would take the team to the next level, and for O'Neill to also be they're 2 points apart, you know, for O'Neill to be a very good coach at Wolves as well.
Sensible, balanced football analysis. I know. It'll never catch on, Tom. You've got no future in this game. Well, speaking of some football analysis, let's talk about the bottom of the table. Now, you'll remember that cracking Meatloaf-related intro, right? Yeah? Well, 2 out of 3 is exactly what we're looking at the bottom of the table. Come on! Come on! Not bad. Prefer to take that one?
Yeah, definitely.
We'll go back to take that for the outro then. but we have Nottingham Forest, Luton and Burnley, and I promise we'd come back to Forest. 26, 25, 24 points. Which 2 out of 3 are going to be bad? See? See? I'm trying. Alison?
It's defying, almost defying analysis, this one. Because I think last week I said I think Forest are in trouble because this is the part of the season where you find energy and optimism is really important. But Forest seem to be expending too much emotional energy on conspiracy theories, and it could be what pulls them into real trouble. And yet, the way they played against City defied all that. They looked like they weren't simmering with resentment suddenly. They looked like they were prepared to put football first and not, you know, what other people might be doing. They played with a freedom that didn't tally with their position in the league. So on that performance alone, I now think, well, if they can do that, then yes, they'll be fine, because they are playing football that is too good to be relegated with. But I they'll find out this week if they get a reduction in the points penalty or not, and depending on that, how that goes, that might sort of create a different atmosphere. I mean, if they're semi-successful, it might not only literally help but psychologically lift them as well. So I might well be U-turning, because I don't know where Luton get. There are a lot of factors that Forest can abuse or use, but Luton don't have anything new in their life. They are a team that have been overachieving, clinging on, and that sense of us against the world, look at us, we've got players who came from League Two all the way up, that romance has become a tiny bit stale.
They look like the ball is kind of caught with them, but I don't know, something about me doesn't want to write them off yet. I kind of look at their games too, Everton home, West Ham away.
Is that a fear about, you know, we've talked a lot about, is this good, is this them good, is this them bad? Is that based on Rob Edwards and Luton, the brilliant job, and you think they
Luton
might fire themselves up
Luton,
one last time?
Luton
or
as a club, yeah.
Are you worried about Forest?
I'm definitely worried about Forest, but I'm just Luton as a club, I think, and having two games at Kenilworth Road, including the last one, I think they could surprise us yet. But Burnley, the Forest need to get it done before going to Burnley, because you know, Burnley have got Newcastle and Tottenham, and I'd be surprised if they get points from that. So Forest have the opportunity to really put this to bed when they play Sheffield United. You know, they're already down. They could be a bit liberated. It's at Bramall Lane. You never know. And then Chelsea at home. I think that's that. I would hate for Forest to have to go to Burnley and like not lose, because I wouldn't be confident about that.
It's all still to play for, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the relegation battle and the battle at the top of the league for many more shows to come. Alison Rudd, Tom Allnutt and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll see you on Thursday. Gary, take it away. I just want you back for good.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.